Imagine a laboratory that studies mind-matter interaction, clairvoyance, precognition, distant healing, and other forms of anomalous perception and action. Imagine that, that studies a person's psychic abilities. Is it possible? It sure is. It's happening right now, and in a moment, Dr. Dean Radin joins us to tell us all about it on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Dean Radin earned his Bachelor of Science Engineering degree, magnum cum laude, in electrical engineering from the University of Massachusetts. He also has an MS in electrical engineering, a PhD in psychology, both from the University of Illinois. For 10 years, he conducted research on advanced telecommunication systems at AT&T's Bell Laboratories and GTE's laboratories. And then for the majority of the last 20 years, he has investigated psychic phenomena in academic and industrial positions. Dean served as a member of a classified research project investigating psychic phenomena for the U.S. government at SRI International and headed Psi research programs in the Silicon Valley for two scientific and industrial think tanks. He has been a senior scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences since 2001, and he's also an adjunct facility member at Sonoma State University in California. Dean's research has been featured in numerous magazines, and he has appeared on a number of radio and television programs. In addition, he's the author of the book called The Conscious Universe and Entangled Minds as well. Dean Radin, back on Coast to Coast. Always a pleasure to have you back, Dean.
Thanks very much, George. Always happy to be here.
What is going on with the Princeton eggs? Somebody has sent me an email, and they thought it was going to be discontinued. And I figured, well, if anybody knows, it's you.
The reference is to the laboratory shutting down at the university. But the Global Consciousness Project was actually moved out of the university a number of years ago because the head of that program, Roger Nelson, who was at Princeton, had retired. So the program is still going 24 hours a day, will continue to go for the foreseeable future, and is associated with Princeton in the sense that Roger Nelson is an emeritus from Princeton.
Well, excellent. So the Global Consciousness Project, alive and well, what's its most current status then?
Well, one of the new analyses has been looking at this anomaly that we found when we first did a detailed look at the data from around 9/11. And the curious thing about that was not so much that we saw a significant deviation, because it was a major event, but that the deviation began about 2 hours before the events began to unfold, as far as the rest of the world knew. So this looked like a premonition effect in the network. And so we were thinking of how do we go back and look for other cases like this to see if that was an accident or maybe it wasn't meaningless mm-hmm. event? And what one of our analysts came up with, his name is Peter Bancel, he's a physicist living in France, he decided to look at all earthquakes of magnitude 6 or above. These are all major earthquakes.
Sure.
Over the 8 years of data that we currently have. And these were, most of these were not events that we had looked at before, but the nice thing of having a long-term database is that you can go back and look at previous events. So we separated these earthquakes into ones that occurred on land masses, which would have affected people, and earthquakes that occurred mostly in the ocean and that did not produce a tsunami, so basically only the fish cared. And then the question was, first of all, do you get an effect in the network? Does an earthquake around people create an effect? And maybe it does around the oceans, too. We didn't know. And also, do we see a change in our random network before the earthquake? And so to make a long story short, yes, you do find a significant deviation when there are earthquakes around populated areas, but not when it's in non-populated areas. So that gives us a clue that we're dealing with the reaction of people. And the second thing, which is actually more interesting, is that between 2 and 8 hours before the earthquake strikes, the deviation has already started to occur significantly.
We know for a fact, Dean, that animals pick up on upcoming earthquakes hours in advance. The Chinese, they're experimenting now with snakes. They think snakes might be good earthquake barometers. Do you think that somehow in the human being, they also pick up, but we're just not aware. And through these random generators, they're able to perceive the ability of a human being to pick up, for example, an event like an earthquake.
I think that is one plausible explanation. I think in cases of animals, though, that animals, the senses, the ordinary senses of animals are in many cases way beyond ours. And so, for example, elephants are extremely sensitive to infrasound, extremely low-frequency sound. And it may be that before an earthquake, the earth starts to literally rumble, and they can feel that or pick it up, whereas we can't. But on the other hand, given that we now have evidence that the random network begins to change and that appears to be related to consciousness in some way, then yes, I would say that it's plausible that it's picking up something like what some animals may pick up.
Dean, you've explained it before how the random generators work, but it's always fascinating to me, and for the many new people who join the program each and every night, explain to us again how the random generators function.
Okay, first I'll explain what the generator is like, and okay. then give a metaphor for what we think is going on. So the random generator is simply an electronic circuit that produces sequences of zeros and ones. It's like flipping coins very quickly. The source of randomness in this case is actually called a quantum tunneling effect in one of the components inside the circuit. And through this monitoring of the quantum world, we essentially can flip coins. The circuit is also designed in such a way so that it is shielded from the rest of the world as best as we know how to do. It's inside a metal box. It runs off a computer, which is on an uninterruptible power supply, typically not directly into the main line, but through a battery.
Okay.
And in other words, so we create as good a random generator as possible. So now we have 60 of these devices running in most major cities in the world. I mean, 60 major cities in the world. And the idea was we wanted to base this on a concept like the electroencephalogram, or the EEG, mm-hmm. on a person's head, in which you have little electrodes that you stick all around the head, and you can infer what's going on inside the head by monitoring each one of these electrodes. So we call the random generators eggs, and the EGG stands for electrogaiagram. So Gaia, referring to the goddess of the earth.
Exactly.
So we're taking a gigantic electroencephalogram of the earth's head, in essence. And similarly to an EEG, and when you look at the signal of an EEG, it looks like a random walk. It has a certain cyclic nature to it, but the raw signal looks pretty random. And it's only when you begin to look at lots of these random signals that you can begin to discern patterns in what's going on inside the head. So in a similar way, we take our eggs scattered around the world, and we're able to do statistical analyses, which is analogous to what you do for an EEG, to see if we can figure out what's going on in the mind of Gaia.
The electrodes, and I'll say that, the electrodes for the eggs, how do they, assuming they're picking up consciousness, how do they do that? How do they sense it?
Okay. So here we have to go to an analogy.
Okay.
The analogy I'll use is a tsunami detector in the ocean. So the way you'd create a tsunami detector is you begin by taking a buoy and you put it somewhere in the ocean. And then you take a couple thousand more buoys and you just scatter them all over the oceans. And each buoy is designed in such a way so that you can monitor, say, the height over the average level of the ocean.
Okay.
And if you then had a radio transmitter which transmitted all of this information to one central site, and you combined all of that data and you're able to graph it, what you would see is a kind of wiggly line, a random line, because
okay.
it's the combination of lots of little random movements. When a tsunami occurs, it creates a gigantic wave in the ocean. And suddenly you'll see a wiggly line is no longer random, but the whole thing starts drifting up. And if you see that, you know that over thousands of miles in the ocean, all of the buoys are lifting. Well, that's important to know. That means a tsunami is about to occur underway.
It's on its way, yeah.
So what we have then is by analogy, when we have a whole bunch of buoys moving. We're looking for a large coherent effect in an ocean of water. The eggs that we use are looking for a large coherent effect in the ocean of consciousness. And in a close analogous way, it's as though the eggs are floating in a medium. Now, it's not the medium of water, but it's a medium like the atmosphere or like the water. These eggs are floating in consciousness.
The ether, whatever we want to call it.
Well, it's more than ether. It's like an intelligent ether. We make a hypothesis that consciousness is somehow distributed out there. We're part of that, but it's a gigantic field. And so if that field changes in the direction of coherence, which occurs during large-scale world events, then we imagine that our eggs will act like tsunami buoys, and they will change their behavior in a collective way, and that's then what we look for.
Phenomenal. Can one person affect the generators, Dean, as strongly as a million people, or do you need the great masses to do it?
Well, there's 50 years of experiments looking at what happens when one person tries to influence a random generator. And so we have a rough estimate of the magnitude of that effect. It would be very nice if you had a billion people all participating at the same time to see if you get a billion times effect. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to run an experiment that involves a billion people. It's even difficult to run experiments that involve more than two people.
True.
So the Global Consciousness Project is actually somewhat different than what we know from the laboratory because, obviously, when we run these large-scale experiments, we're not asking people to do anything. We're simply inferring by the fact of the event itself that there will be a big change in the degree of coherence of attention. So a lot of people paying attention to an effect is a kind of mental coherence. In a laboratory, what we usually ask is someone to pay intention, to intend that the generator behave differently. So they're not directly comparable. But to specifically answer your question, the answer is no. We don't find that we get that the effect scales up by factors of millions. And actually, I'm not too surprised at that either, because if let's say that 100 million people were involved in something like a meditation. Well, that's a sizable majority of the or proportion of the world's mind, but it's not that big. I mean, there's still an enormous number of other people thinking about other things, and that will produce a huge amount of noise in the system. So again, use it by analogy with a tsunami. If you have a very large boulder dropping in the ocean somewhere, the tsunami detector will detect it, but it's also having to compete against all of the rest of the weather and weather patterns right. And ocean in the world, so you end up with a fairly small effect. You would need something like 90% or more of all of the people in the world all participating in the same way at the same time in order to get a much larger effect.
Who keeps the Global Consciousness Project alive? I mean, are you funded, I would hope, by the government, in some cases with grant money, but I'm not so sure. I don't think they fund those things.
This is almost entirely funded by wealthy donors.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, not by grants, foundation grants, and not by government money. No.
Which is unfortunate, because you should get adequate funding. Maybe you need more generators, too. Maybe your data would show you even more results. What do you think?
Well, our original idea was to have thousands of these eggs scattered around. And the reason is not only to increase the rich nature of the data that we get, but also to allow a topological analysis of what's happening in the world. And so, like in an electroencephalograph, if you have one electrode that you stick on somebody's head, you can get some information about that. But if you put 256 electrodes around somebody's head, you can actually begin to pinpoint where things are occurring in the head.
You sure can. Okay, you've got 60 generators around the planet. Is it important that these generators be placed where they are? Or, you know, theoretically, can they be in just one spot?
That's a good question, and it is one of the reasons why the generators are scattered around, to be able to address that question. This is one of the limitations, though, of not having quite enough generators. But to answer your question, in a case like 9/11, we figure that the greatest intensity of effect would be felt around New York City and Washington.
Sure, you think so.
And so we had some eggs running in the East Coast, some in New York, and some near Washington, that we were able to compare against other eggs around the world. And if you simply segregate the eggs by the North versus the South Hemisphere, and then by continent, and then by coast, you keep cutting the data, you end up with fewer and fewer eggs in each case. But what we were able to see is that, statistically speaking, that the northeast of the United States was where most of the deviation was occurring. But that said, the actual egg with the largest effect was in Brazil. So
that's interesting.
This is why we'd like to have lots and lots of these things, but we work with what we have.
And again, with regards to 9/11, how far in advance did you start seeing the spikes?
Well, it was about 3 hours, two to three hours in advance.
Could you, Dean, say now beyond any certainty that the spikes that you saw from the generators told you that something was about to happen? Maybe we don't know where, maybe we didn't know what, but that there was something going on.
You mean for that one event?
Yes.
Was it
so significant that you could read the data and say, my gosh, this is unusual. This is big, but we don't know what it is, but yeah, something's happening.
Well, we have two ways of looking at the data. We have a formal analysis, and these are when we make a prediction about an event before we look at the data. And, of course, we did in that case as well. Before we looked at the data, we predicted that we'd get a certain result. We did get a significant result. But because of the nature, the meaning of that particular event, we did a number of other exploratory analyses. And so the reason I segregate the formal analysis from the exploratory is because when you get into the exploratory realm, you can learn many more new things, but you're not quite sure that it's as meaningful as it may appear. But that said, four of us did a very detailed analysis of all kinds of statistics associated with 9/11. And we found each of us, working a different way, found significant anomalies associated with 9/11. I since have gone back and looked, did the same kind of analyses for other days, and 9/11 sticks out. So my guess is that within the bounds of statistical answers, yes, there was something very peculiar about what was going on in the network that day.
Is there a central clearing point for the 60 generators? Do they all funnel information to one computer, and if so, where might that be?
They do. Every 5 minutes, they send their per-second data. They package up their per-second data, send it to a server at Princeton, New Jersey, and that collects them all every 5 minutes. So on a five-minute scale, we have what amounts to a near real-time picture of what's going on in the network.
We're going to talk about some of the experiments that you've conducted with the Global Consciousness Project. And also, let me ask you, Dean, is it possible with the millions of people listening to this program right now, later on in the program, can you direct them to think of something to see if those generators will spike and maybe get back to us in a few days to say, at this time, George, we did this and we did see some data? Would that work?
That would work in principle, but I would need to set it up in advance with Roger Nelson.
Okay.
He's really the prime mover on this, and I'd want his permission.
Okay. Next time we do that, let's plan on that.
Okay.
And we'll do that. Lots more to talk about with Dean Radin. Plus, of course, the big question all of you are asking yourselves, are these generators spiking now? We'll be back. We've got three websites associated with Dr. Dean Radin. They're all linked up at coasttocoastam.com, so get up there and take a look at those. Incredible work being done here. And, of course, the Institute for Noetic Sciences, we'll talk a little bit about that. Established from former Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell. We'll be back in a moment with Dr. Dean Radin on Coast to Coast AM. Dean, we have conducted some experiments on this program before. The most recent, we just collectively thought of this horse, Barbaro, that has since been put down. He broke his leg in the Preakness. He was the Kentucky Derby winner.
Yes.
And that night, I mean, they thought they were going to lose him, and this was many, many months ago. And we just did a mass consciousness, you know, trying to put light down on the injured portion of his leg. And even though I think great vet work did a tremendous job keeping that horse alive for so many months, he miraculously started to heal the next morning.
Uh-huh.
And it was an incredible story. And I sometimes think that we do have collectively the ability to do things like that. But how far can you push the envelope with things like that? I mean, is there an end to what we can do?
Well, that's a very good question. There's two ways of studying specifically this healing effect that you're talking about. I've mainly studied it in the laboratory, but I've also been involved in clinical trials. And the difference is, in a clinical trial, you're interested in an actual healing outcome. In a laboratory, you're interested to see whether you can get a measurable effect, but you're not so interested in whether it's specifically a healing effect. So on the laboratory side, we have very high confidence that if one person thinks about another person, they send their intention towards them, that there is a physiological reaction in the other person at a distance. There's a smidgen of evidence at this point that having a number of people, like a group that is thinking about a distant person, that you'll get a slightly larger effect, not one that scales up by the number of senders in this case, but a bigger effect. And even a larger effect, as we saw recently in what we call our the love study. These are couples, long-term bonded couples who love each other, one of whom had cancer and was being treated for it, and the other was healthy. And this provided a very strong motivation for the healthy person to mentally assist the one who is being treated for cancer. And in addition, we trained the healthy person in how to provide what we called compassionate intention. And this was based on a number of different spiritual practices in which you learn how to cultivate intention and then send it to a partner. So these people were trained, they practiced every day for 3 months, and then they came into the laboratory and did our standard test to see whether one person's mind can affect another person's body at a distance. And we got a whopping effect. We got the largest effect like this that I've seen so far in the laboratory. So this tells me that a combination of training, of very high motivation, you can definitely see an effect in a distant person. But now the question is, well, what can you do with that?
Right.
You know, does it translate into healing? My guess is that based on the clinical trials that we have so far, the answer is not clear at all. If you were in a scientific court, the jury would still be out. And I think the reason is that most healing attempts, like the attempt on the horse, for example, it does have an effect at the time that the efforts are being made, but you have to continue it. If you just do a one shot, you know, it's like taking one pill and forgetting to take all the rest.
Eventually it's going to catch up with you. And it did with that horse.
Right. So you need to have a continual push against what the body, you know, the body is struggling to repair itself. And if you can enhance that healing through intention, then that might lead to a better outcome.
Can you stop a tsunami in motion? Can you stop an iceberg from melting?
Well, this is the question of how much does all of this scale up? And it's a tricky question because all of the effects that we've seen in the laboratory so far are really small. They're quite small effects. Larger claims for things like yogic flying or levitation.
Right.
And even cases of bending large chunks of metal. I'm not talking about spoons, but like metal bars. There are some cases like this, but you almost can never see it actually happen in the laboratory under controlled conditions. And so our confidence that these things can scale up into really big stuff is pretty low. My guess is that in principle, it would be possible to do something like stop a tsunami in its tracks. But we don't have any evidence at this point that it is practically possible.
Would you call the science behind, let's say, the Global Consciousness Project, cognitive science or coherence? Is that a category that you would be able to stipulate for this?
Well, I would call it a portion of cognitive science, although in the academic world, they wouldn't consider this cognitive science at all.
Why not?
Well, because in the academic world, cognitive science refers only to what might be considered conventional or orthodox processes in the brain and in the mind. And from that point of view, the brain is equivalent to the mind. In other words, the brain generates the mind, or what
right.
we think of as consciousness. That's the standard neuroscience point of view, and it's not without good reason. There's an enormous amount of evidence that the brain and consciousness are related in some way. I think what the mistake is, though, that the assumption is that that's all there is, that the brain is literally generating consciousness, and consciousness then is nothing else. But all of the evidence for mind-matter interactions, for remote viewing and similar effects, strongly suggests that the brain may generate consciousness, but consciousness also can do other things. So the brain is not the entire answer. It's a big part of the answer, but it's not the whole answer yet.
I agree, because those scientists, Dean, would then assume that if the brain generates consciousness upon death, the brain therefore stops to function, therefore consciousness doesn't exist for that being anymore.
That's correct. Yeah, that would be the mainstream view.
And I think what you're beginning to prove, and others who recognize what you do, that consciousness may be an entirely different phenomenon.
Well, one way I think of it is that up until about a century ago, most people thought that matter and energy were two separate things. And then Einstein came along with his special theory of relativity, the famous equation E equals mc squared,
uh-huh.
and showed that the equal sign says that the energy and matter are actually the same thing in different forms. So just in the same way that ice and water and steam are the same thing in different phases, I can kind of project sometime in the future, maybe decades, in which we see that matter, energy, and mind are all part of a continuum, in which case this is, in a sense, what science is trying to do. It tries to unify apparently different things to create a grand unified theory of how everything fits together. And at present, one of the reasons why the neurosciences discount consciousness as a real thing is because it seems dualistic. You know, you have a brain, a physical hunk of stuff, and then you have consciousness, which seems very ephemeral and very different in type. And this dualism is an uncomfortable topic in science. Science wants to unify. So I think the unification, given the evidence that consciousness is a real thing, one way to think of it is matter, energy, and mind.
You've been conducting some experiments. Tell us a little bit about some of your work.
Okay. When we normally think of mind-matter interaction, I've coined this term of mind-matter interaction of the first kind. And this is when you have mind directed at matter, mind directly at matter. So a mental effect on healing, say, or a mental effect on dice or on cell cultures or plants or water and a bunch of other things. Mind-matter interaction of the second kind would be mind directly on energy. And here we're talking about mental effects on light, or mental effects on radioactive decay, or random events.
Okay.
The third kind, we might call mental effects on space itself. And here, this is more speculative, but it's the notion that you can condition space through long-term intention. And this is most frequently thought of at sacred sites, things like the Great Pyramids, or Devil's Tower, or places where ceremonies are conducted. We've done studies using random number generators simply placed at these sites, and they don't behave quite as randomly as they ought to, which suggests that there is the possibility of conditioning space in some way. The mind-matter interaction of the fourth kind is mind influencing some form of matter, which then in turn influences something else. And here I'm referring to something that the material scientist Bill Tiller has developed. He calls it an intentionally imprinted electronic device. This is an electronic device which is a fairly simple circuit, but it's put into the vicinity of people who are meditating on a specific intention, and it's running while they're meditating for this intention. Then they turn the device off, they place the device somewhere else, and turn it back on, and see whether the intention is, in effect, radiated out from that place. So Bill has reported a number of very interesting experiments suggesting that a device can capture intention, and it can make physical things do things that they wouldn't otherwise do.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And so that leads to a new category that I'm studying now, which is mind-matter interaction of the fifth kind, which is mental influence of food as a material substance, which in turn affects behavior, or affects, and this specifically affects mood.
All right, explain that one.
Okay, so this comes about from a number of different directions. One is, if you pay attention to the consequences of global warming, there are many difficult things that we face. One of them is that fresh water is going to become more and more difficult to get.
True.
The second, then, is that food is going to be more and more difficult to get. So we're talking about hundreds of millions of people going hungry. And that suggests that we probably ought to pay attention to what we know about nutrition to see if we can better understand the nature of why we eat food and what food is doing for us.
A global study just released yesterday, Dean, said that by 2080, 200 to 600 million people could starve.
There you go.
Yep.
So that suggests we either let them starve or we need to figure out some better way of enhancing our food. So when you think about then, well, why do we eat all this food? And the usual answer is that we eat it because we get energy mm-hmm. from it. But that's not quite right. We get energy from all kinds of places. It's not that we're getting energy. We're getting a specific kind of energy. We're getting a coherent energy or an ordered energy. Well, what do I mean by that? By analogy, say that somebody is listening to our voices over a 10,000-watt radio broadcast transmitter.
Right.
That's a certain amount of energy being pushed out into the atmosphere. Well, the station could be playing static, just noise,
mm-hmm.
or they could be playing music and voices. The amount of power in both cases is the same. But in one case, you have a completely random pattern, and in the other case, you have an orderly pattern, which carries information. So what I'm talking about then in terms of a coherent type of energy is the equivalent of the informational form. It's a form of information or energetic information that has a certain structure in it, coherent structure, and that's what we actually need in order to maintain the structure of the body. So one of the nice things about plants is that they take the energy from the sun and they actually make it more coherent. They take this more or less random radiant energy and make it a coherent energy. We eat that, and we're living then off of that coherent energy. So now that we have that, the question is, since we know that if you take a random number generator, or in fact almost any physical target, mm-hmm. and you direct your mind at it, the usual way of what we see in these effects, whether it's a random generator or a cell or something of that sort, you see that it becomes ordered. Its behavior changes in the direction of additional order, which suggests that one of the properties of consciousness may be an ordering principle. It's something that creates order out of things that are otherwise random. Well, that leads to a very interesting possibility. It says if you have a hunk of food, anything from a hamburger to a drink of water to almost anything,
okay,
and you inject intention into it, you are ordering it in a new way, a way that we don't have a direct way of measuring yet, but nevertheless, we might be able to see the effect in the human body when somebody eats it. So now I'll step back again and give from a different perspective. Why is it that mom's chicken soup almost always tastes better at home than if you go to the restaurant and you get the same ingredients out of a can?
And why does it always seem to cure a cold?
Yeah. Why is it that the idea of the home-cooked meal gives everybody warm fuzzies, or most people warm fuzzies, and it's almost it's not even directly related to how good the food is. There's something about the idea of the love that is that goes into the intention behind the cooking.
Fascinating.
It's an offer of it's like a material offer of love, and then you eat that. And it's probably not a coincidence that virtually every religious tradition has a ritual that involves blessing food, water, or wine.
And prayer, how about a prayer at the dinner table?
This is, and this too. And even in a completely secular perspective, you can look at the behavior or the act of giving a toast. You can toast with food, you can toast with water. Basically, every culture in the world does this.
Sure.
So there's almost this inkling that we have that there's something important about intention and food. Like you can manifest the intention in the food, and then you can eat it.
Okay. Once you do, and I agree with you that you have the ability, we have the ability to do that. Once we create this intention in, let's say, food, and we eat it, then what? What does it do for us?
Well, the hypothesis, the postulate is that it provides a certain degree of order. The food itself will do that, but the intention might do that as well. And so one way to, before I describe the experiments that we did,
all right,
I'll describe coming at the same issue from another direction, which is the extreme direction. Sometimes you can get a clue about the extreme. So the extremes I'm talking about here are now the breatharians and the people who do the Qigong practice called Bigu.
Mm-hmm.
These are people who don't eat, who claim basically to never eat
or
haven't eaten for years, and they have some cases they don't drink anything for years. Well, by any conventional biochemical standard, this is completely impossible. This is like levitating. It's not possible because there's no means by which people can gain enough energy, ordered or otherwise, in order to remain alive. So I ran across a case that came out a couple of years ago of a man named Prahla Jani. He's an Indian sage who's a breatharian who claimed that he hadn't eaten or drank anything for decades. And, of course, you know, when you hear stories like this, you have to be skeptical because it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
So nevertheless, this is a story reported. A hospital, he was taken to a hospital in India and watched 24 hours a day, both with people and with closed-circuit TV, for 10 days to make sure that he didn't eat or drink anything, and they took continual medical tests to see whether or not he was going to go into renal failure or pass out, whatever. There were about a dozen doctors in residence watching this. The person in charge of the project was actually a high-ranking official involved in the Ministry of Defense in India, who I happen to know. And their conclusion was that for those 10 days, this person did not eat, did not drink, did not go to the bathroom, and seemed perfectly fine. His blood chemistry did not change.
Amazing.
So this presents a major anomaly. Like if this is even conceivable, then we have to rethink what we mean about nutrition.
Yet the average person, Dean, who didn't meditate or do whatever he did, would have died in a few days.
That's right. So then sometimes people say, well, this couldn't possibly be true because there are people who are starving. And to which I reply, that is true. But on the other hand, I could swing a golf club, and for some reason, I don't get the same scores that Tiger Woods does. So what's the difference? A huge amount of practice and a huge amount of talent.
Tell us about the experiments when we come back. Dr. Dean Radin, our guest. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Dean, you didn't have a chance to finish up on what you were talking about on that fifth area of concentration on food and behavior, and then we'll get into your experiments.
Okay. Part of the additional motivation for this issue on food is a discussion I had a couple years ago with a lady named Dr. Anne-Marie Colbin in New York City. She's been teaching what she calls holistic nutrition for a long time. And as we were discussing it, she really brought to my attention this notion that there's something about the chef's intention that makes a big difference in the people who eat the food. And even in a very mundane case, for example, a really good restaurant will have, if you go into the back kitchen and you see what's going on, it may be a very efficient, but it's not an angry place. If it's too angry, like we see sometimes with celebrity chefs on TV,
sure,
I'm not sure I want to eat that food.
Well, that's true. Or keep in mind fast food places where generally some of the workers aren't happy that day.
And then you have a double whammy.
Yes.
You have food which is not so great for you in the first place, made by people who may not be so happy. So it raises questions that begin to challenge the biochemical model of food. So this led to, for years I was thinking about how do we do an experiment involving this. And last summer, a gentleman presented himself and to me, and it turns out that he owns the only chocolate plantation in the United States, which is in the big island of Hawaii. And the plantation is called Hawaiian Vintage Chocolate. Their website's hawaiianvintage.com.
All right.
And he said, well, this is a very interesting idea, because he also had the sense that there was something interesting about intention and food. And in his case, when he originally brought the cacao trees over to Hawaii, nobody knew if they were going to grow or not. But as it turns out, that his plantation is next to a Buddhist monastery, and the Dalai Lama came to visit one day and was intrigued by the cacao trees, and so he blessed it. So this plantation basically began with a blessing from the Dalai Lama. You can't go bad from there.
You can't beat that, no,
right.
Not at all.
So he's interested in this intentional idea, and we said, okay, well, if you give me the chocolate, why don't we use chocolate as the food in this experiment? Now, I did this for a couple of reasons. One is that whenever you do a clinical trial, it's usually difficult to get people to volunteer for it, because they have to do something that's different during their daily life, and it may involve something unpleasant or whatever. In this case, though, we had to recruit people by saying, I'll tell you what, if you'll eat chocolate for 3 days, at the end of that, if you fill out these questionnaires, I'll give you $20. So we were overrun.
You would think they'd give you the $20
yeah.
after those 3 days.
Well, now that we did the experiment, we could have made probably more than $20. But the idea was we wanted to get at least 60 people, and after 120 people started beating down our door, we realized that this was probably a good design. So the experiment worked like this. And by the way, I would like to go back later to experiments involving water and
okay.
also photons, but I'll just concentrate on chocolate for the moment. The experiment was, first of all, it's a clinical trial, which means that it's not something happening in the lab, but it's happening in daily life. It's a real-world experiment. It's called a double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled design, which is the gold standard in medical research. And what this does is it means that since we're giving people a substance to eat, like you might give somebody a pill to take,
mm-hmm.
they don't know whether it's a placebo or an active substance.
The old-called sugar pill, right?
Exactly. In this case, it's chocolate. But it's chocolate that's either treated by intention or not treated by intention. And the double-blind part of it is that not only do the people eating the chocolate not know what they're eating, but I didn't know, and my research assistant didn't know either. So none of us could be biased by the handling of it or anything else.
Who did know?
Actually, the way we designed it was that the person who owned the chocolate plantation knew. He's actually a co-author on this paper.
Okay.
But he then prepared the chocolate elsewhere, gave it to us. So he was hands-off once he gave us the chocolate.
Okay.
We had nothing to do with any of the other participants. So we chose 60 people, and we divided them into groups of 15, four groups of 15. So this is a small-scale study, a pilot study. One group would get chocolate that was not treated. It's off-the-shelf chocolate that comes from Hawaiian Vintage Chocolate. You can buy it through their website. It's like a gourmet brand of chocolate of 68% cacao.
Okay, now when you say not treated, chocolate without that intention?
That's right.
Okay.
The same chocolate you'd buy right through the website. Then we had three different kinds of intentional processes that we exposed the other chocolate to. The first people exposing it or putting an intentional imprint were a pair of highly experienced meditators from the Deer Park Buddhist Center in Wisconsin. So this is a famous Tibetan Buddhist monastery and two, the highly experienced meditators were asked to think a very specific intention to impress into the chocolate, which was in front of them.
Okay.
The intention was that a person eating this chocolate would experience an enhanced sense of energy, vigor, and well-being. We thought that was a safe enough thing to try to influence into the chocolate. And we explained it to the meditators, and they thought that was fine, so they went ahead and did it. The second method was to take a different batch of chocolate and get six meditators, also from the Deer Park Buddhist Center. And instead of having the chocolate actually in front of them, they had an electronic device which would capture their intention. This was the idea.
Mm-hmm.
So they meditated around this electronic device with the same intention. The device was then placed for 5 days in the vicinity of a batch of chocolate and allowed to, quote, play back the intention for five
Basically
days.
Basically beam itself at the chocolate.
Right.
Okay.
The third method was a ritual performed by a Mongolian shaman that visits the United States once a year. His name is Zorikpatar Banzar. He's a chief shaman in the in Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia. I've seen pictures of this place, and it's like being on the moon. It's in the middle of nowhere, so it's a very classic Mongolian shamanism. He actually did this ceremony in our lab here in California, and I was present, and my research assistant, Gail Hasen, was also present. And we basically watched him do drumming and chanting and that sort of thing for about an hour over the chocolate. So then all these chocolates were all prepared independently from us and packaged in such a way so that all we knew is that they were A, B, C, and D.
Okay.
And we didn't know which was which. So we got those A, B, C, Ds back. We distributed it among the 60 people, randomly assigned to each group. And now the instruction for each person was, for each day over the next 7 days, we want you to fill out at the end of the day this mood questionnaire. The questionnaire is a very standard thing used in medical research and sociology research to see how mood states change as a result of some sort of intervention.
Is it a long questionnaire?
This one is actually a fairly short. It's 35 questions. They all have to do with adjectives that describe various kinds of feeling and mood states.
Huh.
And you'd answer each question on a scale from not at all to extremely.
Okay.
So it's a 5-point scale. This is then broken down into subscales having to do with the degree of tension you feel and depression and anger and vigor, fatigue, and confusion. And then you can combine all of those into a single score for mood. So they're told in the evening of each day over 7 days, think about your day and fill out this mood scale. Now, the first 2 days, they just do that. They don't eat any chocolate, and we do that to provide a baseline. The third, fourth, and fifth day at 10 a.m. and 3 p.m., they're asked to eat a half an ounce of chocolate.
What a great experiment, Dean.
Yeah, well, they liked it. And, of course, we chose 10 a.m. and 3 p.m. because that's when blood sugar tends to drop and people are sort of hungry anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
So it wasn't difficult to get people to comply with the instructions.
And a couple ounces is, you know, an inch by two, something like that?
Well, a half an ounce in each case. So it was a total of 1 ounce of chocolate per day for each day, which is like a candy bar. It's not that much.
Okay.
But this particular chocolate, like any gourmet chocolate, is extremely rich. You know, it's very high cacao content. So we told people, don't chew these up and swallow them. Don't wolf them down. Take each one of these little tabs. Each tab is like the size of a button. And just let it melt in your mouth and be mindful of how wonderful it is.
Savor it.
Right. And, of course, they had no idea whether this was the treated or the non-treated chocolate, but it was still chocolate, so how could it go bad? So they did that for 3 days, and then the last 2 days of the week, they didn't eat chocolate, and they just recorded their mood. Now, the hypothesis was that there would be an increasing difference in their reported mood state for people who ate the intentional chocolate as compared to the people who ate the control chocolate.
Moods would be better. They'd be happier, more jovial.
More vigor. I mean, specifically what we were intending, more vigor, less fatigue, and a sense of well-being. Enhanced over the other chocolate. So we did this. Then the overall analysis showed that there was a significant improvement in the people who were eating the treated chocolate, a 67% improvement in overall mood. And then we did another cut on the data. We had planned in advance that since we recruited a wide range of people, that if a person tended to eat 2 pounds of chocolate a day, then on average, then asking them to eat another ounce is not going to make much of an effect because they're kind of saturated with chocolate anyway.
Yeah, and that's too much anyway.
Well, but actually one person said that she ate, on average, 10 pounds of chocolate a week.
10 pounds? Well, she's going to be a diabetic if she kept that up.
She looked like she could have lost some weight, but who am I to tell how much chocolate you should eat?
Yeah.
So we divided the people into a group that ate less than the overall average amount. The overall average was 3.2 ounces of chocolate per week. So there turned out to be about 40 people who ate less than 3.2 averages, ounces per week.
All right.
And so we figured they would be more sensitive to this substance. It was a combination of both the enjoyment of chocolate plus something else that we hypothesized. And in there we got a much, much bigger effect. As I said, 67% overall, but in the people who only ate less than 3.2 ounces of chocolate, it was 10 times the effect. So their mood actually improved a huge amount. So actually, I was completely shocked at this result. I mean, the design is put into such a way that the double-blind nature of it and the randomized distribution of subjects and so on is designed specifically to get rid of any kind of bias that can
creep
in. And yet it showed up, and it's just mind-boggling to me. It's as close to magic, I think, as I've done any study yet.
What did you conclude by all this, then, with this?
Well, one thing that it suggests, well, first of all, it's a pilot study. So you don't want to revolutionize the world with a pilot study. We're going to have to do a much larger scale study to confirm it. But let's assume that the results that we saw at this point are real. I actually think that they are real. And one of the things it says is that what we know about nutrition is incomplete. Now, in some respects, that's not surprising to me because my entire career has been essentially to say that what we know about factor X is not complete. The world is full of all kinds of interesting things, and science tends to carve out only certain areas that it studies. So this is now studying the possibility that one factor of nutrition is intention, and intention can influence the nature of food itself.
Can intention, Dean, influence food that's not good for you, or only food that is good for you?
Well, we're at the beginning of an entire new realm of experimentation. No one has done this before, as far
Nobody
as I
knows.
Can tell. So we don't know the answer to that. One of the reasons we use chocolate, by the way, besides the fact that it was available from the Hawaiian vintage plantation, and by the way, the owner of the plantation said that I could announce tonight for the listening audience that if you go to that website, that there is still some of the intentional chocolate left over from the experiment that you can buy if you want to.
I love it.
One of the reasons...
Just in time for Valentine's Day.
Yeah. Exactly, although you'd probably be inclined to eat it yourself, I think.
That's true.
So chocolate is interesting because it what we were asking it to do, the intention that we were giving it, was pushing it in the direction that it normally does anyway. The main psychoactive ingredients in chocolate are caffeine and theobromine, both of which are stimulants. And one of the reasons people like chocolate is because it gives you a caffeine rush, and then theobromine gives you a much slower and longer rising rush. And it keeps you alert and makes you feel good. So we asked for the chocolate to do what it does best, but pushed it. What we don't know is if you can take, for example, a tomato, which we wouldn't normally associate with becoming energetic,
mm-hmm.
Can we make a tomato become energetic? Well, maybe, but I think what I'd rather do is find out what a tomato does and push it in a direction that it wants to go anyway.
And also experiment, if you're ever going to do this, on genetically modified foods to see what happens to them.
Well, ultimately, where we want to go on this is, as I mentioned early on, that if we're going to have hundreds of millions of people who are starving to death, it would be really nice if we can come up with food that was a lot more energetically nutritious than what we are currently using.
Well, let's say a bowl of rice, for example. If you're able to increase that, the mere fact that that is so readily available, who knows what they can do with it?
That's right. And we're not, of course, we're not talking about the amount. We're talking about not the amount of that's being eaten, but the actual energetic effect of it. So if it turns out that you could be completely satisfied and energetic with 2 tablespoons of rice, that would be great. I mean, there's a lot more food to hand out then.
Oh, that's phenomenal. And you would need how many people to meditate with the intention?
In this case, in one of the treatments was, oh, by the way, there are 3 different kinds of treatments we used. We used the shaman, 2 meditators,
right,
and the device. There's no significant difference in either 3 of those methods.
Okay, so you have data on that.
Right. So we're able to look at the difference. All 3 of them are significantly different than the control, but we don't see any strong differences. The trend is that the device that the 6 meditators were trying to impress their intention into the device, that gave a bigger result. But we don't know yet whether it's a significant result because there weren't enough people in that group.
I wonder if you can invent a device that doesn't need the human element to create the intent. What do you think?
Well, I think you need the human intent to begin with. But what we don't know yet about these devices is that if the device really can capture intention, then you can get the best meditators in the world and basically do the equivalent of a tape recording of their intention.
Put it on a CD.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, this really sounds nutty from a scientific perspective to capture intention in a device. And so I'm thinking, you know, my scientific colleagues already think some of the stuff I do is nutty. And it doesn't bother me too much because I know that at the leading edge of science, you're always going to run into stuff that just doesn't look right. But nevertheless, the evidence is what it is. You know, we're getting an interesting effect.
What does Edgar Mitchell think about some of these?
Well, Edgar likes all of this stuff. I mean, he was one of the original heroes who had a mission to outer space. And on the way back from the moon, he decided there was a new mission, which was equally interesting, which is the mission to inner space.
Kept it to himself, I guess, with his friend on Earth?
Well, at the time, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, so he founded the Institute of Noetic Sciences essentially as a place to have a mission to inner space. We want to find out, well, what is consciousness? What are the limits of consciousness, and how does it relate to the rest of the physical world?
Hey, Dean, when we come back, talk with us about the water experiment that you did and the one on photons. And then again, I'm going to ask you if these random generators are picking up current spikes, because a lot of people think something's going on. We might as well get it straight from the horse's mouth. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we're with Dr. Dean Radin. Dean, are you familiar with the work of Dr. Masaru Emoto, with the work that he's done with intention on water crystals?
Yes.
Amazing, yes. Isn't it?
It is amazing, yes. And in fact, the experiments that I've done with water were in collaboration with Dr. Emoto.
Okay, tell me about that one.
Well, we had an opportunity to meet, and I asked him questions about his claims about water because they look too good. I mean, it looks like it's an effect which is a very large effect and rather easy to produce.
Mm-hmm.
And if my work in this field has taught me anything, is that nothing is quite that simple and certainly not that easy. So I asked him whether someone had tried to replicate his effect using double-blind procedures, and the answer at that point was no. So I asked him if he'd like to collaborate on the study, and he said yes. So what we did was we had the possibility of completely replicating his system, which involves looking at the crystals under a microscope in a walk-in freezer, because otherwise the water would melt too quickly.
Sure.
But as he described the process to me, I realized that I didn't think I wanted to spend a week in a walk-in freezer looking at little ice crystals, partially because it's expensive and also because who wants to do that? So the way we designed this then was we would provide water to Dr. Emoto's laboratory in Tokyo, and he wouldn't know whether the water was treated or not treated. by intention. And then that way we could tell whether the treatment actually did anything, even when they were not aware.
He would come back to you and say, look, and you would know what was treated by intention.
That's correct.
Okay.
And this way it would keep any kind of selection bias out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
Because the main criticism, most scientists at least, believe that the books that he's published are highly selected pictures. You know, like maybe you create a million water crystals and you choose the ones that look good.
That happen to look perfect, right?
That's right. And so we don't know how many times do you need to do this process before you end up with a really nice looking crystal. So the first experiment that we did, which was published last September, involved 2,000 people in Tokyo who were shown a digital picture of two bottles of water in our laboratory here in California. So that's about 5,000 miles apart. They're shown that digital picture along with a sequence of pictures from the Google Earth application to show the people in Tokyo where they were to aim their intention, 5,000 miles away. So that evening, they did their five-minute prayer of gratitude directed towards those two bottles of water. The next day, I took those two bottles and two other bottles, which were held in a different location as controls, and I randomized them into ABCD, shipped them off to Dr. Emoto, and told him to do his thing. Crystallize these, and then send me back the pictures of the of each case where you think you find a crystal. So he sent back 40 pictures. And, of course, he and his lab assistant didn't know which ones were from which water. We did the analysis. But in order to keep our own bias out of the way, we asked people over the Internet to go to a website that I created, and they would see each of the 40 crystals in a new random order for each person. And so for each crystal, they were asked to simply mark down on the computer screen on a 7-point scale the degree of aesthetic beauty that they would assign each picture. So now we had thousands of people. We actually ended up using 500, the first 500 people. But lots of people went to the website and put down what they thought of each picture. And now we were able to create what amounts to an average aesthetic assessment of each picture done by lots and lots of people.
Fascinating.
Now, the overall statistical analysis separates ABCD into the two bottles which are treated and the two bottles which were not treated, and there was a significant difference between the two in the direction that Dr. Emoto claimed, that the treated crystals were on average slightly better but statistically significantly better looking than the ones that were not treated. But the other thing that we saw from this experiment was that most of the crystals actually don't look that good. And in fact, in most cases, there's no crystal at all. There's just a blob. So the very beautiful crystals that show up in his books are selections, and they occur approximately 1% of the time. Nevertheless, because that experiment was significant and it tended to support his claim, we then did a next step. We did another experiment. That experiment is now submitted for publication. It's out there being prepared for a journal.
Okay.
This is now a triple-blind experiment. And the triple-blindedness meant that now everybody in my lab, with the exception of one third party, was blind to which bottles of water we were handling. So we had one person who arranged the bottles into three different categories this time. Two bottles that distant groups would be aiming their intention at. In this case, it was mostly from Germany, total mm-hmm. of about 2,000 people. A second group of two bottles, which were directly underneath the two that were being aimed at, but were not known to the people sending their intention. So in other words, imagine a digital picture with two bottles in it, and that's what you're aiming at, but below that picture on the floor are two more bottles. And what this does is it creates a control that is very close to, but not known, at least not consciously known, or not known in any normal way, to the bottles that they were aiming at. And then we had a third set of two bottles, which are outside this shielded chamber where all of the intention was being aimed.
That's interesting.
So the reason for these two control conditions now is that what we're really interested in is the two bottles that have the intentional aim at them, and the, what I call the proximal controls, the controls that were very nearby but not being aimed at by intention.
Right.
That was the difference we were interested in. That difference under triple-blind conditions turned out to be significant, again, in the direction supporting the idea that intention makes the crystals more beautiful.
So they get some ancillary fallout, I guess.
Well, no, because the proximal controls were not as beautiful. As
Were not as beautiful?
No, not as beautiful.
Okay, so and they were, I didn't get it. All right.
Yeah, they were within a couple feet. But since the people sending their intention didn't know about them, apparently there was no spillover, and there was a significant difference between them.
So you have to be aware of your direction, or you have to be aware of how you're channeling your intent.
That's what the result of this experiment would suggest.
Okay.
Yeah, that the there wasn't a field effect occurring, but an effect directly on this water itself. But again, in this case, after all of the pictures came back, only about 1% of the images would be considered a very beautiful image.
See, that's disappointing to me. I would have expected that to be way, way up there.
No, I think if it was a very high percentage of very beautiful crystals, then I would be suspicious. I mean, you don't get results that are that robust. All of the effects that I get in the lab, including even the effect with chocolate, the actual magnitude of the effects are pretty small. We know with high confidence that they're real effects, because that's what the statistics can tell us.
But I mean, are you going to get good crystal pictures without the intent as well? I mean, is that going to happen randomly?
Yes, it will. Some of the control pictures will result in crystals that look quite good. It's just that you end up with a larger number of better-looking crystals on average with the treated water than you do with the control water.
But why only 1 or 2%? Why not a little higher, 10, 15, even 20%? All right, not 70 or 80, of course, like I would love, but why can't they get it higher?
Well, we don't really know, but the one speculation is that we're dealing with a couple thousand people who were over 5,000 miles away, so there may be an effective distance.
I wonder if the same people who worked on and meditated the intent on the chocolate, if they were pulled in on the water, I wonder, because of their abilities, if the crystal pictures would have been higher percentage-wise.
My guess is yes, and we have some evidence that in this realm, intentional talent makes a big difference.
I want to talk about your light experiments in a second, Dean, but a couple quick questions. One, of course, is a lot of people are interested in these random generators. Are you seeing any spikes now?
No.
You're not?
No.
Okay, well, that's a good sign.
Yeah. And by the way, and those we have over 200 formal events that we've analyzed so far, and the overall odds against chance for all 200 events is about 1.2 million to 1. So we have very strong statistical evidence that something is going on, but on the basis of any one event, we still can't predict if it's going to work or not. We need approximately 30 to 40 events, big events, worldwide events, in order to get a statistically significant effect. So even with the eggs, we're dealing with relatively small magnitude effects, but the statistics sound impressive, like 1.2 million to 1, but all of that's really telling us is that we have high confidence that what we're seeing is not a chance effect. But the size of these effects are fairly small.
You have been studying psychic phenomena for a long time, 25-plus years. You've got a story that I want you to tell us that you find to be pretty bizarre. Why don't you tell us about it?
Well, I guess before we get to the photon experiment. Yeah, this is something that is simultaneously hilarious and horrific, and I take it as a cautionary tale. We need to go back in time to November, well, first of all, to 9/11. And as you remember, that after 9/11, the U.S. at least was determined to bring somebody to justice, and we figured out that the Taliban were supporting al-Qaeda in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
So we invaded Afghanistan, and everybody was concerned about weapons of mass destruction and whether al-Qaeda had it and so on. So on November 6th of 2001, CNN reports its headline, Bush says Bin Laden seeking nuclear bomb. A couple days later, CNN reports, or Christiane Amanpour reports, mysterious, ominous documents found in a safe house that was bombed by the U.S. in Afghanistan. This was an al-Qaeda safe house. They found mysterious documents. The next day, the headlines for CNN is, nuclear attack, now anything seems possible.
Yeah, I remember that.
And the next day or two, the headline is, nuclear weapons-related documents found in this al-Qaeda safe house in Afghanistan, a discovery made even more significant in light of Taliban threats to bring about the destruction of America. So then there was a BBC report, a filmed report, showing some of these documents. And somebody noticed, I didn't notice at the time, but somebody noticed that the wording in this document looked a little bit strange. It was having references to uranium-235 and to atom bombs, references to TNT and so on, and headings which said things like how to make a nuclear bomb, which appeared to be downloaded off of the web somewhere. So a couple of years go by. You know, obviously there were no nuclear bombs, although there's still threats about dirty bombs.
Right.
But for about a period of a week or so, everybody was completely freaking out over the possibility that al-Qaeda actually had or was directly involved in some way in making a nuke. So now we go to a couple of years ago, and somebody comes to me and said, well, you know, your story was picked up by CNN and the Taliban. What do you think about that? I'm saying, what? What are you talking about? So as it turns out, the information that the Taliban had downloaded from the Internet, among lots of other things, it turned out that they downloaded a story that I had written in a humor magazine in 1979. And the story in the humor magazine, the title was Weekend Scientist, Let's Make a Thermonuclear Device.
Oh, no.
And this is in a science parody magazine where I give instructions, a 10-step instruction about how you can build a nuclear weapon in your kitchen with common kitchen utensils.
Oh.
And you can tell then that this is exactly what was found by the BBC reporter and then was, of course, flashed around the world. And it was talked about in the Pentagon, and you know, Bush is raising the fear over it. And, of course, I had no idea that the story which I wrote in 79 had sort of bubbled in an underground until the Internet came along, and then it was replicated and copied again and again on lots of websites all over the place, none of them with the attribution of who the author was.
Oh, my. And it was a spoof.
It's a spoof. So the cautionary tale here is that I just wrote something for fun back in 79, which turned out to freak out the world almost 20 years later.
That's amazing. And the Taliban's running around thinking they're going to create a nuclear bomb out of household goods.
Well, no, they would need plutonium. And they would need
They've got to have that, of course.
Yeah, they'd need some soap and water, and I tell them they probably need a metal can and a few other things. But, I mean, the idea of how to make a thermonuclear device is fairly easy. But, of course, actually creating it to make it work is extremely difficult. The reason why I wrote this piece back in 79 is because at that time there was a student at MIT who, for a senior thesis, I think, he went to the local library and he figured out from public documents, how can you make a nuclear weapon just as an exercise?
Right.
Well, this made the news, and it went all the way up to, I don't know if the Supreme Court, but it went up to very high courts that were now determining whether or not this kind of information should be public because, you know, maybe people shouldn't know how to do this.
Yeah.
So I wrote the parody by saying that this information has been public for a long time. None of this stuff is secret at this point. The details of it are secret, and the ability to get enough plutonium and so on, those are extremely difficult, and rightly so. But the idea that that the courts should declare that we shouldn't be able to know something that we already know, I thought this was ridiculous, and that's why I published it in this parody journal.
Dean, when we come back at the top of the hour, we'll talk about your light experiment, and also we'll take phone calls. As the Global Consciousness Project proceeds, what do you see in the future for it?
Well, I would like to see that we begin to look at other forms of eggs, other kinds of detectors. Now, we've talked to colleagues who are working, for example, with giant neurons as a form of a random system.
Hmm.
The reason why this is interesting is because it kind of makes sense to us. We don't know if it's true, but it makes sense that a living detector would be better than a non-living detector, because if we're dealing with something to do with consciousness or sentience, then there's something interesting about living systems that is involved with that.
Yes.
So a neuron or perhaps an organic semiconductor or a plant would be a very interesting form of additional egg to add to the system.
All right, stay with us, Dean. We'll be back with you in just a moment. If you need to email me, that's simple. It's george@coasttocoastam.com. When we come back, we'll open up the phone lines. I can't believe how fast this program has been going. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, Dean, tell us about the light, the photon experiment. How did that work?
Okay, so the interesting thing about photons is that they live down at the quantum level. And with the quantum level, lots of things that we ordinarily take for granted at our human scale kind of go away. And one of the strange things, for example, is that a photon is either a particle or a wave, or it behaves like a particle or a wave, depending on how you decide to look at it. One of the classic ways of showing this is with what's called a double-slit optical design. And this is you shine a photon at two tiny slits close to each other, a couple microns apart. And if you know which slit the photon goes through, then you end up with something that looks like a particle. And if you don't know, it looks like a wave. The knowledge of which slit it goes through, the jargon is called which path information.
Mm-hmm.
If you know which path the photon has taken, then you will cause it to behave in a different way. And so I was wondering whether it's possible, certainly if you do this with your eye, if you're able to somehow see with your eye, you would collapse the wave function, as it's called, or you collapse the interference pattern. But can you also do it with a clairvoyant eye? In other words, with an eye at a distance that is not your physical eye, but some other form of knowing. And the reason I thought this was an interesting experiment is because it addresses a question about psi in general, psychic abilities in general, which is that from an experimental point of view, almost all of the definitions that we have of this are negative. In other words, we can say it's not this, it's not that, it's not a lot of things, but it begs the question on what it is. So if it turned out that a clairvoyant eye that gained which path information in a double slit design collapse the interference pattern, then we have a positive definition for psi, which is that it is an information-gathering means. It's a way of gaining knowledge about the world, in which case the clairvoyant eye and the physical eye actually are quite similar in how they operate. So rather than using a double slit, which, as I said, the slits are only a few microns apart, it would be difficult to see with your eye anything, and it's even difficult to describe with someone how you would stick your clairvoyant eye into such a small spot. I use something called a Michelson interferometer. And this is the same general idea as a double slit, except that it separates the two paths into macroscopic differences. So they're at right angles to each other. Each path is about 4 inches in size. So I explained to the subject in the experiment that I want you to put your clairvoyant eye along this path, and I mean a 4-inch path on this apparatus. And then once they get the idea that they're supposed to move their eye at a distance, so to speak, and see if they can see the incoming photons and gain which path information, then the optical apparatus is shut and enclosed inside a room so that it's completely sealed. It's, first of all, at a distance, but it's also sealed from any other form of light because this, the camera that is looking at the interference pattern is sensitive down to individual photons. So it has to be extremely dark in that room. And in fact, we can calculate that in the apparatus, there's roughly 50,000 photons per second in the apparatus, which is very small. I mean, it's extremely dark. I asked the subject then to sit outside this shielded room and to go into a meditation. And when I asked them to see, to put their clairvoyant eye into the other room, they should do that. And they do it for 30 seconds. And then I tell them, okay, now stop and withdraw. And they do a counterbalanced sequence of being asked to look into the apparatus and then take their mind away from the apparatus. And I figured that to ask somebody to do this in a very stable way for 30 seconds at a time, if you asked an ordinary person to do this, they can do the task for maybe 2 seconds, and then their mind will wander. So I needed to use people who are very used to being able to put their minds on something and leave it there stably, which are advanced meditators. So I did an experiment using both highly advanced meditators and also people who were either beginning meditators or had not meditated at all to see if there was a difference. And this addresses your question earlier on whether this kind of training makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
So what we found was that the non-meditators ended up doing 9 sessions like this. They got overall chance results. There was no difference when they were trying to see the photons versus not seeing the photons. Camera saw the same amount of illumination. But in the 9 sessions with advanced meditators, and I'm talking about people with up to 50 years of meditation practice, including one named Swami Veda, who's a teacher of teachers of meditation, they had an extremely significant result, a very robust statistical result showing that when they were trying to gain which path information with their clairvoyant eye, the interference pattern collapsed in the same direction that it would have collapsed if they actually used their real eye, their physical eye, to see. And this then provides an inkling about what is actually going on when we talk about remote viewing or clairvoyance. It is a means of gaining knowledge about the world that acts upon the world in the same way that our physical eye does.
That's amazing. I mean, all the experiments that you just mentioned are all amazing.
Yep. Well, that's what I do for a living.
Good for you, Dean. Let's take some phone calls this hour. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Yeah, hi, George.
Yeah.
George and Dean. This is Moni Vital from San Diego.
Hello, Moni.
Yeah, hi. I couldn't believe it, listening to your guest talking about breatharianism. This is the first time that you had that on your program, and I had to call and tell you that I used to be a breatharian for 18 months, and everything he said is totally true. And I just wanted to add something to what he said, which is on the same line, that breatharianism, it's about not believing in food. I mean, it's totally, you have to deprogram yourself to a place where food is not an issue in your life. Because normally people who eat believe that they must eat in order to stay alive. And
right.
For a breatharian, it's a non-issue. And just another freedom from the culture of death, you know, because...
How long have you gone without eating?
18 months.
What about drinking water?
I did drink water starting the third week when after I stopped eating. I start drinking water. You know, normally there's 21 days process to quit eating, and I just followed this up on my own, and I really didn't care for the water, but my girlfriend was forcing me to drink because she was getting worried by the hour.
How much weight did you lose over those 18 months?
Well, most of the weight you would lose in the first 10 days, and then you go to an optimal weight, and you stay there. But you have to remember, you have to exercise. There is no way, if you don't exercise, you would look like a Biafra child. You have to exercise. Whether you're slim and skin, but however you are so powerful, your actual power will triple or quadruple, you know, when pushing, like, weight and things.
That's right.
Regardless if you eat or not, you know. So, you know, this is just another freedom.
How did you look, though? Do you look healthy?
Oh, I look great. I look the most amazing. I'm shining. Everybody would notice you. You know, I'm not a tall person, but I walk like the tallest man in the world. I mean, it's power. You know, it's energy. Everything is flowing perfectly.
You've gone back to eating?
Oh, yeah, I did. You know, this is very difficult not to eat in this culture. I mean, socially is disaster. You can't go out. You can't have any relationship with anybody. Cheap dates, you know. It was the most difficult thing I've ever done.
And you're in Los Angeles. The restaurants are pretty expensive out there.
Yeah, so I came back to eating. But, you know, now food is not the issue. Now, you see, once you quit eating, then you know you broke all the natural human limitation of our culture. You see, I don't get sick. I don't age. I have no limitation in my life. You know, I broke one of the basic two rules of life, that you must eat, which is nonsense, absolutely none. It has nothing to do with food. You see, we have two different systems of digestion and breathing. You know, the breath, your lungs, is your digestion system. The air that comes in every time you breathe is the number one digestive system in your body. All the nutrients coming through the air. The food that we eat, merely, we think that's feeding us, but it's not. Actually, it's sucking the energy away from us.
Did you take a vitamin pill
never.
Or a supplement?
I never do either today. I am a naturopath, and I, you know, even though I tell my client, you know, take this, and that, but I don't. Everything that tells me on the label that it's good for you, I would never touch it. You know, just as a rule. You know,
Here's a weird question. I mean, did you go to the bathroom?
Well, at the beginning, after you quit, you go every 4 weeks. Pellets come out. You know, like a little bird dropping. And, I mean, you'd be surprised that even if you don't eat for maybe the fourth, fifth month, still every once a month you need to go for one more drop to come out.
Yeah, this actually was found in the case of the person who was in the hospital for 10 days.
Right.
They found that his bladder would fill with water, but it would become reabsorbed.
Yeah.
Was it difficult for you to stop eating in the beginning?
No, actually, I really never cared for food, and I know from my work, you know, I do research myself, and I went for sure to quit. So I had to reprogram myself, who I am. So I deprogrammed all my beliefs from my growing with my parents and how food is important and food is love and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And once I cleared all this up, it wasn't easy, just a piece of cake. You know, I don't need it. I'm going to live. I'm not going to die. So it's all nonsense. You know, everything we know in our life, it all depends on the belief system that we live in. The culture tells you must eat, then you must eat. This is not quitting eating. I mean, no, this is quitting eating. This is not fasting. You know, if you fast, you will die. I mean, because you believe in food. I don't believe in food.
Now, that I assume, Dean Radin, and thank you very much, Moni, was the key ingredient here in doing what he did. Because if somebody went into it thinking, I'm going to starve or I'm hungry, it's not going to work, right?
That's right. Yeah, I think it may be slightly more than simply belief. I mean, there has to be a way of sustaining the energy. And what he says is true, that in a lot of traditions, your breath is where the energy comes from. You breathe in prana. You breathe in life energy, which is around us all the time. There hasn't been very much research in this area, but I certainly have heard stories like this before, and I'd like to see some research done on it.
What creates that hunger pain, though, when you don't eat?
Well, initially, I imagine, as he said, it takes 21 days to sort of wean yourself off. And if you can survive the 21 days and convince yourself that you don't really need the food, and you have a way of learning how to draw in the energy that you need or convert the energy from some other source, then the hunger probably goes away. I mean, people who go on fasts for, say, a week, you have very very bad hunger pains for a couple of days, but then after 4 or 5 days, you really don't feel that hungry anymore.
Now, I'm a believer that the body has organs for specific reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Why were we created with a stomach and a mouth and, you know, intestines and an esophagus if we weren't meant to eat?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, if we imagine that evolution is pushing us in a certain way, then it's conceivable that our entire digestive apparatus is a vestigial form. And in other words, like the appendix. We don't need the appendix. We don't even need the spleen to some extent. So it's possible that once consciousness reaches a certain stage that it is able to transform itself into a different form of creature.
What an incredible phone call that was. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hi there. This is Karen in Houston. Hey.
Hey, Karen.
Well, as Jesus said at one time in the scriptures, he said, I have meat you know not of. And then he would go off by himself and he would, you know, meditate. And also it says in scripture, my people suffer for the lack of knowledge. So this program is really filling us up with what we need. And I remember on a previous show, there were astronauts that were experiencing something that one of your guests brought up, that when they were out in space, that their helmet shields did not protect their eyes enough from the light rays from the sun. And so as the rays would hit their eyes, they were seeing like these geometric shapes and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a language coming through to them. So they had to have their shields changed out. And so I think that's a form of evolution, is through these photons that you're talking about. It seems like an evolution of knowledge that we lack, and then upgrading in our consciousness possibly. And I know our eyes have a lot to do with how we absorb, you know, what's all around us and how we look at things. And like you said, the third eye, which would even be more potent, three instead of just two that we have to use. So, and also holy water is, you know, it's when you expose water to sunlight, so something comes in through that. And when we put a protective light shield around ourselves, like worker in the light, you know, the light has so much potential, and it is a life-giving thing. So I think the more we absorb of that, the more we know how to differentiate the different photons that are coming at us, I think we'll have, gosh, a whole new world of existence and consciousness.
And assuming all this is correct, Dean,
mm-hmm.
Where's it coming from? What's out there in the universe or in another dimension that allows us to be able to tap into it?
I don't think it's coming from anywhere. It's a little bit like asking if you see a dandelion floating in the air, and it suddenly jumps up. You would be inclined to say, well, what caused it to, you know, it decided to do something, it jumped up. Well, it got pushed by the air currents. It got pushed by something which is invisible, but which is the medium in which it resides. It's surrounded by it. So I think we are surrounded by and embedded in a sea of energy. In fact, we know that this is true from the quantum world. Zero-point energy permeates everything. We're always surrounded inside it. It's inside us and outside us and everywhere. And so we don't need to go look for it. It's already there.
Might this be God?
Whether it's God or not, I don't know. I don't know whether we can think of something like a zero-point field as having intelligence. I mean, I imagine that I would think most people would think of God as having a supreme intelligence of some type. And whether this has intelligence, I don't know. But we know that it's there. It's a source of energy.
Absolutely staggering. The experiments continue. How long will the Global Consciousness Project last?
We hope it lasts as long as we're all continuing to be interested in it. There are quite a few people involved. Each one of the 60 eggs has a host, a human with a computer, and all of those folks are still interested in it. So there's enough people now to probably sustain it as long as we wish.
Well, you know, you've got your support here with us, Dean, on Coast to Coast. Stay with us. We'll be back with final phone calls in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. This is our final segment with our special guest tonight, Dean Radin. We'll take your phone calls as well. Dean, of the three websites we have for you, do you recommend any specific one over the others?
Well, the DeanRadin.com, I have a blog, which I use now to correspond with people. I used to do this by email, but I found I was kept writing the same emails over and over again. So
that's true. You do
that. I do it on the blog. The IONS website is interesting. We have a nice conference coming up in August that you can sign up for through the website. And I don't know whether you have HawaiianVintage.com up there or not.
No, we do not have that up there.
Well, you might add that because if people are interested in sampling this chocolate that we used in the experiment, then you can get some.
That's amazing. Really is.
Yeah. Well, we're in the midst right now of discussing a much larger experiment. I mean, doing what you usually do in a clinical trial, you start with a pilot test, and then if you think you got something, you go on for a much larger trial.
That's yeah, I guess do. You can conclude through the pilot test, there's something really going on here.
Right. The pilot test tells us we have justification for taking the next step for going to a larger trial, because the larger you get, the more expensive it is to do.
If you were me, Dean, would you continue with these mass consciousness experiments?
Well, as I mentioned with my story about unintended consequences, you know, here I wrote an innocent little humor article, and it turns out that 20 years later, it freaks out the world.
Yeah.
So we don't really know what the consequences of pushing the world around with our minds are. And it's just something to keep in mind. You know, I think that, as you did with the horse, that a single shot may have well done something, but without continually doing it, you may not actually get much of a lasting effect. So single shot experiments probably have an interesting outcome that you might be able to measure. But I don't think it affects the entire world very much.
See, I think we've moved hurricanes, but I think we've pushed them in other directions.
Well, like a butterfly effect.
Yes.
Yeah. You might be able to deflect certain things from happening. But a lot of things out there also have a lot of inertia. You know, that if a tsunami is on the way, that has an enormous amount of inertia behind it, and it would be very difficult to deflect.
Might even be more energy than the mind.
Yeah.
First-time caller line, you're up with us. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Good.
Good. Provocative program, as always, George. Fun.
Thank you, sir.
Dean, good show. Hey, just wanted to ask you a question on how you guarantee randomness. And while I've been on hold, I've been listening to you. And, you know, we live in an age of information overload. You know, you're talking about your spoof, your writings 20 years ago, and the unintended consequences. What do you do to try and desensitize your subjects as much as possible?
Desensitize the subjects from...
Well, basically, in all your studies, you're trying to have total randomness. You're not trying to have anybody that's influenced or, you know, has a bias. So
I see. That's a very good question. What we use in our in clinical trials anyway, we use standard methods. The standard method of, in this case, it was a randomized stratified sample. What that means is that you have a pool of people to choose from, and you randomly pick them and then stick them into the four different categories so that each of the four categories ends up with the same averages, the same average gender, the same average amount of chocolate eaten, and so on, for all of the variables that you're interested in. Whether the distribution is truly random or not is a good question, because that is a place where unintended effects might actually appear. And given that we have some evidence that through intention you can start pushing randomness around, it actually raises an important issue about any kind of experiment in which people are assigned to random conditions. Because if, in fact, the experimenter's intention is to get a good result, then they may unconsciously, and they're not fooling, but they somehow magically will distribute people in a non-random way so as to give them the results that you wish to get. And this is an unresolved problem. All the best that we can do is use the gold standards used in medical research. And if it passes through that filter, then at least we know we're not dealing with an ordinary form of bias. But there are psychic forms of biases as well, and those we really don't know how to deal with yet.
Well, it's like any science, just like us, it's an evolution. So perhaps a review of this will take us in other directions.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
okay.
Very good question.
Okay, thank you for being on the program. Next up, we'll go east to the Rockies. Your turn on Coast to Coast. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. This is Don in Chicago.
Hey, Don.
I have some questions. You know, I've listened to the show on random number generators for many years, and I still don't know what some phrases mean, and I wonder if you could define or illustrate them. Things like off the charts, spikes, numbers no longer being random. Exactly what is this? Is this like a seismograph or something? Or, I mean, what does it mean to be off the charts and things spiking?
Well, if you've ever watched a random walk, data that shows a random walk, somewhat like an electroencephalogram might show, there's the randomness will walk within a certain band. And it'll go so high and it'll drop so low, but it sort of wanders around a midpoint.
So what is being depicted, a straight line, like a line, or are numbers being depicted?
It's showing the, in this case, it's a measure of variance. I don't know how to explain that easily.
Oh,
without...
I see. There's no pictorial or anything. It's numbers that you analyze, standard deviations and things like that.
Exactly. It's a running standard deviation, essentially.
So when something spikes, you're talking just about a standard deviation that maybe increased value or something. Is that what you mean?
That's exactly it. Standard deviation becomes much too wide, and of course you can measure statistically. What that means, if it becomes so wide that it's beyond three or four standard errors, then you know that you have the quote spike and that you're getting a very unexpected statistical result.
See, I thought you had like a clean white sheet of paper and a needle going up and down or something, but it's nothing of the sort.
No, it's a statistical graph.
Well, what about numbers no longer being random? It's still, again, it's the standard deviation?
That's correct, yes.
Huh? Okay, well, then that takes care of that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right, thank you, Don. I appreciate you being on the program. I understand you're also preparing to explore the future, Dean, through the window of the soul. Tell me about that.
Yes, it's a nice-sounding title. What we're going to do is, for a number of years, I've been looking at what I call presentiment, which is an unconscious form of precognition. And I make a discrimination between presentiment as a pre-feeling with precognition, which is pre-knowing. Because in presentiment, you don't actually know what the future is, but your body responds to it. So we've done experiments now where we've measured things like skin conductance changes before a shocking stimulus. And we can show that your skin conductance, which is a part of your autonomic nervous system, begins to become aroused before a shocking stimulus as compared to a calm stimulus. Typically, we see this around 3 seconds before the stimulus occurs. We see it also in brain slow cortical potentials in the brain, and we have some colleagues now who are looking at this in the heart. And so unconsciously, the body seems to respond to things which are about to unfold. We respond to our future unconsciously. One area that has not been looked at yet is the eye, literally the pupil dilation in the eye, because we know that if you see something shocking, your pupil will dilate because it's part of this fight and flight response.
Yeah.
You want to see more information quickly. And then after you process what you've seen, it'll either stay dilated or it will constrict. So we're going to use that in the presentiment experiment, where we'll simply have someone look at a blank screen, and a few seconds later, after they press a button, they will see a picture. It'll be an emotional picture or a calm picture. And what we're interested in is, what does the pupil do a couple of seconds before that image appears? And we predict that if you're about to see a shocking picture, that your pupil will begin to dilate before it actually appears. And if you're going to see a calm picture, your pupil will not change. So that's one part of looking through the metaphorical window to the soul into the future.
Okay, let's go to our wild card line. You're up with us. Hi there.
Is that me, George?
Yes, sir.
Hi, you doing tonight? Thank you. Good. Very good show tonight. You know, I was wondering, I've got a couple of statements and a couple of questions, and I'll take the answers off the air.
Okay.
First of all, what were the people doing in terms of diet prior to the studies, as far as the non-food diet that the doctor was talking about?
Okay.
And also, I believe there was a guy by the name of George Ives Gurdjieff that did similar experiments physically with yogic exercises, and he came up with various exercises himself, including non-eating. And also, I think it would be really a good idea to have someone talk about Gurdjieff. Are you aware of who he is?
I'm not, Dean.
Yes, I am. Yes.
Okay. There's a book called Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, and it's about an extraterrestrial dropping off his grandson on the planet Earth and explaining what strange characteristics these beings on the planet Earth have. It's kind of semi-fiction. Also, I would like to say what energy level did the people have when they did not eat regularly? Did they have strong energy, physical energy, in terms of were they able to continue their normal activities without the food, and what properties, again, are in the chocolate that he was talking about?
Okay.
I think we lost him.
Yeah. Okay, so the first question, I think, pertained to the chocolate experiment. Were people dieting in a special way? And the answer is no. People were just going about their daily life in the usual way, the only difference being eating chocolate on 3 days and keeping track of their mood. So there was no attempt to restrict people in any way. As far as Gurdjieff's testing of what's sometimes called breatharian or inedia, meaning not eating, I'm aware of those studies, and it is a long history of yogic tradition where not eating is a part of it. In fact, just a few days ago, I was visited by a man who is part of a group that gazes at the sun when it's rising for a few minutes before it becomes so intense that it would harm your eyes. And they claim that through the process of gazing at the sun, that they get all of the nutrients and energy that they need. And then to answer the third question, what happens to your energy level? Now, first, for people who don't eat at all, the ones I've met who claim that they don't eat, I have no way of verifying that, but the claim is they don't eat, and their energy level is the same as anybody else, maybe even better. They look robust, they seem energetic, so it boggles the mind. In terms of the chocolate experiment, the energy level and the level of vitality and the drop in fatigue both improved when people ate the intentional chocolate as compared to the control.
Okay, let's go to our east of the, well, we'll try west. He's been on for a while. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good, sir. Thank you.
It's Tim from Phoenix. I was listening to a lot of things you were saying on the break, on hold, I should say. Part of it sounded like Stephen Hawking with the probability theory, and also Carl Jung with symbols, psychic symbols.
Sure.
I was talking about the clairvoyance you were talking about, Dean.
Mm-hmm.
And then what I was going to ask is if you go down to, like, psychics or, like, mediums, like, say, Jane Roberts, who supposedly had the Seth being come through her, and Edgar Casey. And I just kind of wonder if there's a cross between symbology and mythology and also physics.
Hmm. That's a deep question. That's a deep question that probably requires more brain power than I can apply at this late hour. I assume that the answer is yes. In fact, I'll just tell a short story here that Eugene Wigner was a Nobel laureate physicist who wrote a very interesting paper with a title on the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics in the physical sciences. And what he meant by this was that there seems to be something almost magical, and he used words like that in his paper, to say that the mathematics seems to contact the physical world in the way that the Platonic forms seem to contact. Something about mathematical and geometrical aspects of the world that have their own independent truth to them. And this may be a way of understanding why mathematics are so effective in the physical sciences. One example is that Newtonian physics is extremely accurate in determining and predicting where the planets are. And then quantum mechanics beyond that is like 10 orders of magnitude even more accurate. So the question arises, how in the world can mathematics so precisely describe the way that the world actually is? One of the proposals by Sir Roger Penrose, a mathematician in the UK, he also agrees that it almost appears as though mathematics is in contact with the Platonic forms, which is quite interesting.
Sure is. Final call or two, and then we are wrapping it up. Our wildcard line, you're on the program with Dean Radin.
Yeah,
hi there.
This is Alan in Dallas.
Okay, Alan.
I need to know if they lose weight when they don't eat. But my question is, do you think that there might be more information than a bit of information in a quantum photon? And then just one bit. We can only measure one bit, but maybe there's more information than that.
There certainly is a lot more information in a what's called a qubit, a quantum bit. And in fact, because there's much more information, in fact, an infinite amount of information in a qubit as compared to a bit from an ordinary computer, this is what's the impetus behind the development of quantum computers. In fact, I was just at a conference in Switzerland a couple weeks ago where we were talking about the possible relationship between quantum computing and consciousness because of the similar notion that quantum computing is such a huge leap beyond ordinary computing that it may leap all the way into the realm of what we think of as consciousness.
Dean, next time we're on, we got to talk about that experiment about people who have feelings of being stared at. That's fascinating indeed. But the time, the clock has got us, Mr. Radin. I want to thank you for being on the program.
It was my pleasure.
And good luck with the books, The Conscious Universe, Entangled Minds. Appreciate you being on, Dean, always.
Okay.
For Gina Salvati, Steve Carr, Dan Galanti, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesure, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.